Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Nearly 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed course on 50 years of precedent by overturning Roe v. Wade. The Dobbs decision sent control over abortion back to the states, and that has sent reproductive health care into chaos. The laws governing abortion are becoming a crazy quilt of different rules. In North Carolina, the state passed a law banning the procedure in most cases after 12 weeks and requires 2 in-person visits for anyone seeking an abortion, as well as state-mandated counseling at least 3 days prior. The law passed when the legislature overrode Governor Cooper's veto, with House Speaker Tim Moore insisting the law, quote, will save lives and provide needed support for women and families. That may or may not be true here, but it certainly isn't in other states, where some women have had to fight to get permission to terminate pregnancies that put their own lives at risk. Now there are questions about the future of mifepristone, a drug deemed safe and prescribed for nearly 20 years that has several uses, including early pregnancy termination. Indeed, the future of some forms of birth control are in question as the result of the Dobbs decision. As legal battles are being fought in states around the country, and with this a likely election year issue for voters, we take a look this hour at the politics of reproductive health care, some of the results of overturning Roe, intentional and unintentional, and where all this may be headed. Liz Barber is Director of Policy and Advocacy at the ACLU of North Carolina. She is with us along with Rachel Crumpler, who covers gender, health, and prison health for NC Health News. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. Good
morning. Rachel, I'm going to start with you. Despite the fact that we got some advanced warning about the Roe v. Wade being overturned last year when it was leaked from the Supreme Court, this came as a shock to a lot of people, in particularly reproductive health professionals and women who maybe used clinics as their primary source of health care, particularly in states where they began to enact these restrictions, some more stringent than others. We live in one of the more lenient states for now. How has that impacted clinics and medical professionals here in North Carolina? Because we did change.
Yeah, it's changed a lot since the law took effect July 1st. It cut access to 12 weeks prior to Senate Bill 20 passing. Abortion was allowed up to 20 weeks, so that's 8 weeks that you have fewer time to seek an abortion. So for, you know, clinics, physicians, you know, this is a new era of care. You know, we have to find ways to fit in patients and, you know, adjust to these new requirements. So what I've heard from talking with, you know, providers was specifically in the law, you know, it cut the window of time for seeking abortion. But the other really big change was that in-person counseling requirement that had a dramatic effect. So now everyone seeking abortion in North Carolina has to go to a clinic twice. So this is really a big burden on the patient themselves to logistically get there twice, because North Carolina has 14 clinics in 9 counties. So that's, you know, a lot of travel. Finding childcare, taking time off work. Again, you're doing this twice. That's a really big burden. And then on the physician side and the clinic capacity, they are also having to accommodate those patients twice. So to see the same number of people, you know, they're seeing twice as many visits, if that makes sense. So again, just from a capacity lens, it's just a lot more to see patients, and that really has required them to rework flows. I talked to clinic staff at a Women's Choice. They operate 3 clinics in North Carolina, so they just really had to rework how they think about fitting in these patients, where they're basically doing the counseling in the morning, and then they'll see patients for procedures in the afternoon. So they're kind of operating you know, two different things. So it's really just a reworking process, but they have really risen to the occasion of, you know, seeing as many people as they can and, you know, working under these new requirements.
Liz, I'm going to ask this question probably several times as we go through this program and as Rachel details some of the things that North Carolina has faced. But are there other medical situations where the state tells you what you must do before you have a procedure? And in other words, they're mandating a counseling session at least 3 days prior to getting an abortion, and they're mandating several visits prior to getting one. Is there any other healthcare procedure that does that? And what in the law, in the Constitution, gives them the right to do that?
Sure. In a word, no. You know, the short answer is that there isn't. There just isn't any other healthcare procedure that is regulated by the government like abortion is in so many different ways. The 72-hour mandatory delay between the informed consent and the procedure. You don't see that in any other healthcare procedure, including ones that are dangerous. And abortion is one of the most common healthcare procedures. It's one of the safest healthcare procedures in the country. And the numbers bear that out, you know, year after year after year. Even so, abortion is singled out for the one that has that mandatory delay, right? Implying that someone is not sure or can't be trusted with the decision that they've already made themselves with the people that they trust. And so the government's inserting themselves into that relationship where they really shouldn't be. And another is detailing what has to be in the informed consent. I think all of us know that informed consent is very typical in any healthcare procedure. Any of us who've gone to the doctor's office for anything or taken our children, the doctor tells us what the benefits are and what the risks are for taking a medication or any other procedure. But the General Assembly does not tell the doctor what they must say in any of those other situations where they do dictate it in abortion. And that's really harmful in several ways. One, it's what they put in there is very stigmatizing. And there are other things, for instance, that require a doctor to tell someone, for instance, that the father of the child will be required to pay child support. While that might be relevant in some situations, they also have to tell that to people who are in a relationship that is loving and supportive, and they're having to terminate a non-viable pregnancy. And so that really harms the relationship between the doctor and the patient when they have to add that sort of harmful disclosure to their patients.
Rachel, there are places in this country where women can no longer get abortions. They have to fight for their own lives in situations where pregnancies put those lives at risk. That's put doctors in incredibly awkward positions where doing no harm, which is the Hippocratic oath that they all take, or helping the patient to the best of their medical ability might land them, the doctors, in jail. How prevalent has that situation been? Not here, but elsewhere.
Like Liz's point was like, I've had lots of conversations with people in North Carolina, you know, doctors, and they're like, never did they expect, you know, they went to medical school, they didn't go to law school. So that keeps coming up, even, you know, I think for any doctors, they never anticipated that they'd be consulting lawyers on, you know, a daily basis or a weekly basis, whatever it may be. You know, they want to rely on their medical judgment and know that they are the ones that went to medical school. You know, it wasn't lawmakers who did that. So they kind of know the situations where medical care is warranted and, you know, need their judgment trusted. So it just really is this interference of, you know, the doctor-patient relationship, given, you know, state restrictions across the country. So it really just is entering this territory that I think a lot of physicians are uneasy about and don't think it should be this way, because again, they are the ones who have this medical judgment.
Liz.
Yeah, as a result of that, I think that, you know, it takes some time for us to really see the numbers come out of the ramifications of SB 20 and other abortion bans. But anecdotally, we're seeing doctors leave the state. And, you know, a lot of people like to sort of demonize and otherwise abortion providers and think that that's all that they do. But the truth is that the doctors who are providing abortions are the same doctors who are caring for women and fetuses and complicated pregnancies, maternal fetal medicine doctors, and they're leaving the state. And one said, she said, you know, about 20 times I've already had to have conversations with patients telling them that the law does not allow me to provide the care that they are asking for and the care that medically that they need. And I'm not going to spend the rest of my career having that conversation with patients. And so I'm going to leave and go to another state where I'm able to provide the health care to my patients that I'm trained to do and was within the scope of my work. I think we'll also see that in med school applications and then residency and fellowship placements.
That's Liz Barber, who's Director of Policy and Advocacy for the ACLU of North Carolina. She's here with Rachel Crumpler, reporter on gender and prison health for NC Health News. We're talking about what has happened in the aftermath of the overturning of Roe v. Wade, and we will continue that conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Liz Barber, Director of Policy and Advocacy of the ACLU of North Carolina, and Rachel Crumpler, reporter on gender and prison health for NC Health News. And we're talking about the world following the end of Roe v. Wade and where we are today, about 2 years in the aftermath of that decision by the Supreme Court. Liz, were these instances where doctors cannot do what they are supposed to do if they're following medical practice and procedures, were they unintended consequences of these laws being put into effect by non-medical experts, by politicians, or is this exactly what was intended?
This is exactly what was intended. This was not a fluke or an unintended byproduct of abortion bans, but when the legislature tries to interfere with healthcare professionals making healthcare decisions, this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to prevent people from being able to access abortion, ultimately in all circumstances. I think that one thing that is easy to fall prey to is the idea that anti-abortion folks were really just trying to overturn Roe, and then that would be the end. But it's really clear, it's abundantly clear to me that that's not the end. The end goal is to ban abortion across the country in all circumstances. And we're seeing that. We're seeing the trends right after Dobbs. We saw more and more states passing bans, more and more states getting more aggressive in those bans. And then we see the litigation that's now in front of the United States Supreme Court and will be heard later this month and next month, trying to further restrict medication abortion, which could have huge impacts not only in banned states, but in states that are abortion friendly. And then we also see the Emtala case that will be heard in April.
The AMA, the American Medical Association, has long acknowledged that when the letter of the law would prevent urgently needed care, physicians must have the latitude to act in accordance with the best medical judgment, professional standards and practices. But in reality, when doing that or doing what is ethical or even moral conflicts with the law, meaning that you, the doctor, could go to jail or lose your right to practice medicine or both, can we expect doctors not to take the course of action that keeps them out of jail and therefore endangers patients' lives, Liz? Are they putting themselves in legal jeopardy by doing that? Could they be sued by the patient?
Sure. I think that we're seeing both. And I think not only sued by the patient, but in fact, jailed. So what we're seeing in Idaho, that's the Emtala case that I was referencing earlier. Emtala, it's the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. It's a federal law that was passed in 1986. And what it does is it requires any hospital with an emergency room that receives federal Medicare funds, which is virtually every single hospital, that they provide emergency care to stabilize a patient in any circumstance. Idaho, after Dobbs, passed a total abortion ban prohibiting abortions in any circumstance. So the DOJ responded, seeking to enjoin that law, prevent the government from enforcing the law in a very narrow circumstance, in the circumstance that someone presents in an emergency situation and an abortion is necessary to stabilize them. saying you cannot bring criminal charges against doctors who are providing abortions in that specific instance. And the lower court agreed, but now the Idaho is appealing that all the way up to the United States Supreme Court to say, no, even when a woman's health is on the line, that her life is on the line, a doctor must not provide care. And if they do, they can go to jail. So it's really scary times that we're living in right now.
Rachel, the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education requires access to abortion training for all OBGYN residents, and nearly 45% of those accredited programs are in states that now have abortion bans. How damaging is this likely to be to the OBGYN field in the future? And are we seeing the damage already happening? In other words, is this, if you can't get accredited because you can't have the training, then is that going to discourage potential doctors from becoming doctors in those fields?
Likely. I mean, for a lot of physicians, you know, especially OBGYNs, you know, part of their work, you know, involves abortion care. That is a part of reproductive health care. So they want to be able to practice to the full scope. Like, that is a piece that they want to know how to do. So obviously you need to get that training. So training really is in jeopardy in some of these states, and trying to figure out how they can, you know, get those skills is kind of what we got to see is happening. And as Liz spoke about earlier, you know, residents want to go places that they can train, you know, so states with abortion restrictions maybe are going to be less appealing, and people aren't going to want to go train there.
The Center for Reproductive Rights has produced a color-coded map that shows the entire country, all 50 states, in terms of where they rank in terms of their abortion laws. 11 states: California, Oregon, Washington State, Minnesota, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, Vermont, Connecticut, Maryland, and Hawaii expanded access after the Dobbs decision, meaning they have created additional access to abortion care, I guess, to help people coming in from other states. Some states, including the District of Columbia, have protected the procedures. Others have enacted tight restrictions. The map places North and South Carolina into what it calls hostile territory. We, of course, in North Carolina have a 12-week abortion ban with all the requirements we mentioned earlier in the program. South Carolina is enforcing a 6-week ban, which was declared constitutional by their state Supreme Court in August. We have a federalist system, Liz, where there are different laws in every state. There are different traffic laws. There are different laws about alcohol, etc. There are now different laws about medical care. Is that dangerous?
It is dangerous. It means that your health outcomes can be determined on where you live. And not only that, there's a big health equity problem where people who are nearing an emergency situation, who can afford and have the financial means to get to Washington, D.C., to get to New York, to get to California, are going to be able to get a different level of care and an appropriate level of care, where people who don't have those means won't be able to. And then their health will be put at risk by their government.
And Rachel, as you mentioned earlier, these clinics that women used to go to just, well, we thought they went to just for abortions, that was not the case. They went for sometimes all of their health care, other times just counseling. Sometimes they went for prenatal care and things like that. How has that been impacted, the availability of those clinics for other purposes other than abortion, been impacted here and elsewhere by these new restrictions?
I mean, it's just tough. I mean, providers are adjusting to a lot of new rules and a lot of time. You know, a lot of providers have told me just navigating this new law takes a lot more of their time, where they could be providing, you know, other services like contraception or, you know, prenatal, whatever it may be. But again, to counsel in person, you know, requires that time of just logistics and being just talking with people. So again, yeah, we have a strained healthcare system. We already don't have enough providers. So then when additional restrictions get added, you know, it takes more time that maybe we could be spending on other healthcare services that are needed.
When the North Carolina legislature overrode Governor Cooper's veto of their bill putting into place this 12-week restriction on abortion and the need for counseling, et cetera, and two visits, et cetera. The governor said that this would result in clinics shutting down and women not receiving care. Has that proven to be the case, Rachel?
To my knowledge, I don't know of a clinic that has shut down. Again, it's taken reworking of processes to stay like in the legal realm of this law, but I am currently not aware of a clinic shutting down in North Carolina.
And South Carolina and Georgia restrict abortions now to 6 weeks. Kentucky prohibits the procedure altogether. Tennessee has criminalized abortion. In Virginia, these are all states around North Carolina. In Virginia, abortion remains accessible, but with the legal, but without legal protections. So, is Virginia where people from these states, including ours, are going if they're outside the 12-week window, Rachel, or do we know?
Virginia is, taking on a lot of patients from out of state in the Southeast because it does have kind of the most open rules of right now. Abortion is allowed through the second trimester. There's no mandated counseling and like a waiting period. So it can be potentially easier to access care in Virginia. But again, that now travel distances have gone up. So it's like, can you get there is the question. And for a lot of people, the answer will be no, because again, you're paying for the abortion procedure itself, but you're also seeing practical support costs, so childcare, time off work, those are also adding up tremendously. So the cost for abortion has risen in this new environment. So that's different. And then also people have told me, even North Carolinians who maybe are within 12 weeks, maybe Virginia could work better for their situation because, again, they don't have to go to a clinic two times. You know, they could maybe just go to Virginia once. But again, who can access this? That's the question. A lot of people can't still get to another state.
We asked, but we were unable to have someone from the medical community join us on this program today. So I will ask you, Rachel, as the gender health reporter for NC Health News, a question about the consequences of all these tightened restrictions. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says, quote, abortion is health care. They call it, quote, an essential component of women's health care. For opponents that might find that difficult to understand, can you explain it from what you've learned from your reporting, why abortion is health care and an essential component of women's health care?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what a lot of providers say, that abortion is health care, because again, you know, this is a health procedure. You know, it's a person's, you know, choice of why they might need an abortion. And that is a valid choice for anybody. So that's kind of how providers look at it. And again, there are cases when an abortion is what is needed to save the life of the mother. If a child is, or if a fetus is developing, you know, with fetal anomalies, there are cases where, again, abortion is needed. So it is definitely a part of reproductive health care.
Liz, the American Medical Association says it is steadfastly opposed to governmental interference in the practice of medicine, especially for well-established medically necessary treatments which can be criminalized by misguided abortion laws. That's a direct quote. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists insists, quote, like all medical matters, decisions regarding abortion should be made by patients in consultation with their healthcare providers and without undue interference by outside parties. And they go on to say, sound health policy is best based on scientific fact and evidence-based medicine. The best healthcare is provided free of political interference. Aside from assisted suicide, which remains illegal in most states, I can't think of another procedure that isn't strictly between a patient and their doctor. Should this be? I mean, there are those on both sides of this who consider abortion murder. So is that why this should be so tightly controlled? and interfered with by the government?
It should not be tightly controlled and interfered with by the government. I think that the AMA and all of the major, both United States-based and international healthcare organizations recognize it as healthcare and recognize it as a decision that should be made between the doctor, the patient, and whoever the patient decides to involve in that decision. And it is really problematic. It's problematic on so many levels. One is, you know, doctors go to 4 years of medical school and then they go to additional training after that. If we could put it in a manual, right, sort of what sort of healthcare intervention is needed in any given circumstance, you wouldn't have to go to school that long, right? We're trusting doctors to make decisions based on more information than we can simply write down. And when lawyers and some people who are not even lawyers, but lawmakers decide to try to boil it all down and come up with these very legalistic rules that aren't based in medicine and were made not even in consultation with doctors, it puts doctors in this impossible situation that they know based on medicine, based on healthcare, based on the patient who's presenting in front of them, the best decision to make. But then they have to go this additional step and figure out if legally they're able to do that. And sometimes it's clear to me as a lawyer that they are able to do that, but it's not clear to them. And so they are reaching out to lawyers to get advice whether or not they can proceed. And while all of the lawyers are deliberating what's appropriate in that situation, the patient's healthcare or health is in danger.
Liz Barber is with the ACLU. Rachel Crumpler is a health reporter for NC Health News. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the cases that have already been alluded to that are winding their way through the courts at various different levels, and also what the future may hold, not only for abortion, but for other forms of women's health care, including contraception. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins with Liz Barber, Director of Policy and Advocacy of the ACLU of North Carolina, and Rachel Crumpler, reporter on gender and prison health with NC Health News. Liz, as you mentioned, there are several lawsuits winding their way through the courts to fight back against some of these restrictions that have taken place. And next month, as you mentioned, the U.S. Supreme Court will review Idaho versus United States, in which the court will determine whether medical providers can continue providing abortions to pregnant women in dire medical circumstances under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. Can you take us through that case very quickly?
Sure. So like I said, shortly after Dobbs, Idaho passed a total abortion ban, meaning that no abortion under any circumstances. The federal government sought to intervene and say, okay, there's not much we can do about the majority of this ban, but we are going to try to get a court to say you cannot enforce it when a doctor is providing an abortion in an emergency room in a hospital that is receiving federal funding. You must be able to allow the doctors to provide abortions to women who are in an emergency situation. And Idaho said, no, when we said a total ban, we mean a total ban. And we want the ability to be able to jail a doctor for providing an abortion, even in an emergency situation. And so that's going all the way up to the United States Supreme Court and will be heard next month.
And it puts them in a sticky wicket, the high court. They'll have to grapple with the chaos and the confusion that physicians have faced in the aftermath of their Dobbs decision and the mass exodus of OBGYNs in some states. They'll also have to reckon with the promise that they made in Dobbs to leave abortion access to the states, because whatever they decide in this Idaho case will extend to every state. So they're back in the business of telling states what to do about abortion. Is this normal for the Supreme Court to make a decision and then have to come back in 2 years, 3 years, and second guess themselves and clean up the mess they've made?
Well, I think they really have made a mess. And I think that in some ways it's unprecedented because they overruled a precedent that had been there for 50 years. And so I think it's only natural when you do that, that there are going to be some aftershocks that they're going to have to address.
The American College, is that the ACOG? OG, what is the AC, the American College?
The American College.
Yeah, Obstetricians and Gynecologists. They say that, quote, pregnancy complications may be so severe that abortion is the only measure to preserve a woman's health or to save her life. And we've seen incidences of this happening in the aftermath of Dobbs, particularly in Texas. Are there no constitutional protections for women who find themselves in states where they cannot get an abortion, no matter what their personal health condition may be? Is there nothing available to them to save them?
Well, we'll see what the United States Supreme Court says, you know, next month. I would argue that, of course, that there is a constitutional right to an abortion under all circumstances, or at least that there should be, but certainly that there is when your life is at stake. And one thing that just to revisit the idea that abortion is healthcare, pregnancy, I think many people see it as a blessing, and sometimes it is a blessing, but even with that blessing, it puts a mother's life in danger. I mean, a pregnant person is more likely to have health complications or even to die of complications of pregnancy or delivery than someone who is not pregnant. And so I think just that first decision when you find out that you're pregnant, whether you not want to stay pregnant or not stay pregnant, that is a healthcare decision, because deciding to stay pregnant is in fact more dangerous and there are higher risks of complications than an abortion. And people don't usually see that relevance early on in a pregnancy.
Prior to Roe v. Wade, women went and got what were called back alley abortions from non-qualified providers, often putting their lives at risk, often losing their lives as a result of these non-medical professionals handling this procedure or them doing it themselves. That's people say that's happening today or will happen today. And we know in around the world, Rachel, 21 million women around the world already receive unsafe, illegal abortions every year, and complications from those abortions account for about 13% of all maternal deaths, about 50,000 women a year. Are you aware of these choices being made yet in the aftermath of Dobbs, or is it too early to tell?
I mean, self-managed abortions have always, you know, been around, and that is happening right now. So self-managed abortions are just ones that happen outside the formal, you know, healthcare system. So that is happening, you know, where you can order pills on abortion pills online. But that is safe, you know, if you get them through a provider. You know, a lot of kind of telehealth abortion, you know, sites, kind of like abortion on demand, Hey Jane, like you can see a provider and get abortion pills sent to you. So that's different, you know, telehealth abortion, that could be through a provider. But anyways, yeah, some people are going to self-manage their abortions.
There are states that have, where they have banned abortions, Liz, who also wanted to criminalize crossing state lines to get an abortion. Has that happened?
Well, we've seen lots of proposals for that. I'm not aware right now that that has happened yet.
Would it be constitutional? I mean, we have free access. You don't need a passport to go from North to South Carolina.
That's right. I can't imagine that it would hold up. With that said, we never really know with the current court makeup, because we never thought we would see, many years ago, we never thought we would see the fall of Roe, but here we are. It's really a new world. And so I can't imagine that it would pass constitutional muster to prohibit people from being able to travel.
When abortion restrictions were tightened, Rachel, they're 12 weeks in North Carolina, 6 weeks in South Carolina, there were warnings that women would find themselves one day beyond the cutoff date, and they would have to take those pregnancies to term as a result of being one day behind the deadline, and it would impact a lot of people. Those were the predictions. Has that proven to be true, or do we know?
I mean, I think that's certainly a possibility that's happening. I haven't heard of specifically someone that's told me that's happened to them, but physicians are turning away people from North Carolina that are past the limit. And the question is, they don't know what happens to those people. Do they go out of state and get care? That's a possibility. But it's also a possibility they don't have the resources to do so, So we are left to believe they are likely carrying their pregnancy to term, whether they wanted that or not.
Oh, go ahead, Liz.
Yeah, there's several things that make it complicated to track that. One is we don't know if people are leaving the state to access care when they're not able to get it here. And then the other is what Rachel was talking about earlier is people getting abortions outside of traditional medical channels. And it's a different world than we were in pre-Roe, because back alley abortions, when those were taking place with some frequency, there wasn't the abortion pill. There wasn't medication abortion. And so that's a little bit let the cat out of the bag, because people don't have to go into a back alley, but are able to order the pills online. And at least thus far, I have not heard any reports of those pills being anything other than what they are said to be, and being mifepristone and misoprostol.
And it's often said that with these shortened cutoff dates, a lot of women won't even know that they are pregnant until it is too late. Is there any way to absolutely pinpoint the exact moment of pregnancy so that you can accurately say just how far along a woman is? And if that isn't possible, to accurately pinpoint it to the day, how would you know that you're 6 or 7 weeks, 12 or 13 weeks pregnant? And could the doctor fudge it for you? Liz.
I think that's a complicated question. One thing that became apparent when SB 20 was being spoken about in the legislature is a lot of the legislators do not understand pregnancy dating. I think a common misperception is that if you are 3 weeks pregnant, it is 3 weeks from when from conception. And that's not the case. That means that you would be 3 weeks after the first day of your last menstrual period. And so it is more complicated because the first 2 to 3 weeks of quote unquote being pregnant, you haven't even had sex yet. And so, especially when we're dealing with younger people or people who tend to not have regular periods, it is harder to date. And I know I've had a couple of pregnancies. I know during my pregnancies, every time I went to the doctor, the estimated gestational age of the pregnancy, it varied by a couple of days. So it is not an exact precise science. With that said, I don't think doctors are in the business of trying to fudge it. I think that doctors have too much on the line
Right.
and would not be willing to do that.
In states where abortion has been criminalized, but where there are exceptions for things like saving the life of the mother, do doctors hesitate? What would be the case if if you do this as a doctor because you've determined that the woman's life is in danger and you perform the procedure, but a colleague says, I disagree with that decision. Her life was not in danger. Could you then be prosecuted? Liz?
Yes. Yes, it varies state to state what the consequences could be, if it could be losing your license, if it would be a civil lawsuit or criminalization. But those are exactly the reasons that doctors don't just do what is in the best health interest of their patient, but they do have to be concerned not only about what they think, but then what someone else who's coming behind them, second guessing the medical chart, might think is appropriate.
There are those who say that this Dobbs decision has opened the door to a lot of things like reconsidering, and there are politicians who said they want to reconsider. In fact, members of the Supreme Court have said they'd like to revisit contraception. And mifepristone is one of those pills that have been particularly mentioned and has already kind of had a little dust up. On March 26th, next week, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments on how patients can access mifepristone. The Conservative Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine has asked the court to ban it outright. The court turned that down. What will this argument then be centered around, Liz?
So this argument will be centered around the restrictions in being able to access mifepristone, which has been on the market and FDA approved for decades. It's been out there for over 20 years. It's been safely used by over 5 million people. As a fact, it is safer than Tylenol. It is safer than Viagra. Yet the FDA historically has put things called REMS, which is basically just restrictions on how it is dispensed. And so it used to have to be dispensed in person by a doctor. The FDA later came along and said, you know, that's really not medically necessary. It is a safe drug. We're going to treat it like most any other drug and allow pharmacies to distribute it and allow people to distribute it also by mail. And so this anti-abortion group came along and said, no, it should come off of the market entirely. And if it doesn't come off the market entirely, we want to go back to that in-person distribution directly from the doctor to the patient.
So, Rachel, just this week, you wrote about the first over-the-counter birth control pill available in the United States called Opill, O-P-I-L-L, which will soon be available online and in stores. It's said to be 98% effective in preventing pregnancy. It has fewer side effects than some prescription pills. A one-month supply will cost about $20. Since this is over-the-counter rather than by prescription, might this be the silver lining for women who don't want to get pregnant, particularly in states where severe restrictions to abortions are in place?
I don't think anything's the silver lining for the situation we are in, but certainly having an over-the-counter contraception does make it more accessible. In the past, you know, contraception's only been available with prescription, so that does remove a significant barrier. But contraception, there's so many different forms. So, like, this pill isn't going to be right for everybody. You have to take it at the same time every day. So, like, some people may not be able to do that and may prefer an IUD or something else. So this does certainly hopefully improve access moving forward. But, you know, there's still instances where contraception, you know, doesn't work for some reason. So pregnancies are still, you know, going to come up. And if somebody needs an abortion, that will still be a factor as well.
There are moral, ethical, and medical considerations to all of this and legal considerations now that the Dobbs decision has come down. And it will be a political football throughout this political season. With that, we have to end this conversation. Liz Barber is Director of Policy and Advocacy for the ACLU of North Carolina, and Rachel Crumpler is a reporter on gender and prison health news for NC Health News, North Carolina Health News. Thank you both for the hour. Appreciate it.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.